London Calling, David here. I've got Charles Foreman, affectionately known as Charlie, with me. So this is another in our Meet Your Guide series. Americans, you know, when they know you for 5 minutes, they tell you their life story. Now, you know, our London Walks guides, I've known some of them for years, and I don't know all that much about them. The only thing I know about them is they're great guides. So, Charlie, let's start out with, you know, tell me about, you know, where you got going. What part of the UK are you from, and growing up, and what you were doing before you became a guide, et cetera, et cetera. And hello and welcome, and thanks, by the way.
Thank you. I think I'm pretty much a Londoner, actually. I sort of lived here continuously since the 1970s. Should have been born in London, but my mum and dad moved out to the suburbs, to just outside London, just before I was born. So I've kind of got roots in Camden, which is where they were living, shall I say, when I was conceived, and where I'm living now. So I feel I've kind of done the full circle. And most of my life, I suppose I've been working in housing and regeneration in London from a whole range of perspectives, which all have added to a sense of how much the city matters to me. And it has enriched my understanding of the city.
Uh-huh.
So that's, I suppose, where I'm coming from.
Well, how about, you know, as a youngster, I mean, the line I often use is that no one when they're 7 years old thinks, oh, I want to be a guide when I grow up. And I'm sure you didn't either. But did you, when you were 7 years old, surely you weren't thinking, I want to be in housing? I mean, what was, you know, what were your youthful aspirations? You want to be a footballer maybe, or an actor or a doctor or something?
It was at school, remembering about empty houses.
Really?
Huh. When there was so much homelessness. I sort of volunteered for shelter in the Des Wilson days. And so I suppose, not surprising, I started getting involved in housing from quite an early age.
At a really
And the first 12 years or so was a very, very big learning experience for me. 6 or 7 years in Brixton, working with the community that had its roots in Jamaica. Families who'd come over had never got properly housed, were living in short-term rentals, which were getting knocked down by the council, and they weren't getting rehoused. And it was that group of people that I worked for, really, in my very early years, trying to get them some more permanence in their housing. And I moved from that to working in Spitalfields at the time when the Bangladeshi community was still struggling to establish itself, to make its home safe, shall we say, in Spitalfields. And again, I worked for community organisations there. So I learned a lot about London in those early days. I then became more of a kind of standard council bureaucrat in later years. But that was a great start. For me, in understanding a lot of the dynamics of our city.
Mm-hmm. So you were working for a council, or with the council right from the get-go, or were some of them charities to start with? Or
they were charities, yeah. So in Brixton, it was a self-help housing organisation, which had an agreement with the council to use short-life housing, and I was the sort of administrator of that. And then in Spitalfields, it was with GLC funding, a community organisation, which was managed by a community group. So I was very much directed by people within those communities as to what I should be doing.
So you started in Brixton then, is that right, with this?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
And back in the early 70s, so that's quite a stretch back.
Yeah.
Different place.
And you mentioned Spitalfields. Are there other London neighbourhoods that you worked in as well, in housing?
Well, when I sort of turned turtle and became a local government bureaucrat, there were certain boroughs I spent a lot of time in. And the last of those, this is the end, I'm jumping through 40 years here, was Hackney, which I became extremely fond of. Because I had a job and a role there, which I suppose was very compelling, and I was responsible, I suppose, for trying to see how the benefits of the 2012 Olympic and Paralympic Games could be channeled short and long term into the communities that surrounded the game site, and Hackney's communities were one of those. So I got a very different perspective then on one of the inner London boroughs, but uh-huh. It taught me a lot as well.
So how did that work? Did it, would you be kind of set a project, or was some of it so-called field work? You were out almost going door to door, or you were researching? I mean, yeah, this is a world those of us on the outside know nothing about.
I guess in terms of the Olympics and Paralympics, it was about getting into discussions with the people who were planning the site and its future, and trying to feed into that a sense of how it would best work for local Hackney people in the long term.
Uh-huh.
And then in the shorter term, it's obviously about the most engagement possible in what was happening at the time, from being on the building sites to getting people skilled up for the catering that was going to be involved, to getting people literally into the opening ceremony.
Isn't famously London pretty chaotic and unplanned as metropolises go, or is that all? How's it all changed, Charlie?
I think London is unplanned, and I suppose what I was watching in the '70s was still the kind of that demolition of Victorian London. I mean, a lot of Victorian London was based on 99-year leases when it was exploding outwards. And those 99-year leases were falling in the 1950s and 1960s. And that meant that there was no investment in a lot of those estates because there was very few years left in them, which was where they became sort of prime targets for local governments to redevelop them as council estates, understandably. And that transformation, I think, was one of the biggest that London has ever seen. Because it was that ring around the centre that got to develop pretty much wholesale. Well, I say wholesale, but I mean all the way around, you can see where that happened.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think London's changed as significantly in its built environment since. Well, obviously, it has changed a lot, but that, I think, was the biggest single change.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's why one of my walks, which I did, in fact, yesterday on Docklands, going through Limehouse and the Thames, it's another area which has changed enormously.
Uh-huh.
And you see what's happened to Canary Wharf and how, in a lot of ways, that has left behind the people in the surrounding neighbourhoods which uh-huh. haven't had the benefits that Canary Wharf has potentially been able to bring. And I think that's why the Olympic Park was so significant and important, because it was really key to see that if that sort of investment is happening, it isn't simply going to be there one day and gone the next, or there for a new community which didn't do anything to benefit the people who were in the surrounding areas.
Would you say the rate of change is it accelerating? Is it changing at a greater rate now than perhaps it was a century ago?
I would think probably not. But what there was before Brexit and before the pandemic was this incredible sense of the value of land, so that it was very easy for developers to be able to pick up land and to build kind of high-end residential. And a lot of that has been happening at the expense of housing for people who can't afford that kind of that kind of price tag.
Uh-huh.
So I think that does mean that London is changing, and I think it means it's changing demographically. It's still hard to say what the impact's going to be of all the people who left, perhaps went back to Europe at the beginning of the pandemic. Whether they're going to come back here, I don't know. But certainly I think inner London is beginning to be drained of its family life, of its young children.
Uh-huh.
Some of the inner London boroughs are noticing that their schools are far from full. That's a change that I think is worrying.
I mean, do you think, is Brexit are we losing people because of Brexit as well, would you say, do you think? Or is it too early to tell?
Well, I think it's certainly the case that a lot of people went back to Europe at the beginning of the pandemic. And of course, that was before the final break on Brexit. Uh-huh. And the need to show your registration here, uh-huh, in order to be able to stay on. But I'm not sure they are all going to come back. I have a sort of worrying sense about London, if I'm honest, that if they don't, London's no longer that sort of world destination that it has been for the last 20 years or so. It's, uh-huh, been the most exciting place to come. I've seen London when it was in the doldrums, uh-huh, which I think it was in the 70s and 80s. Don't want it to go back to that, yeah, kind of place.
Yeah. Well, you well know, every London Walks guide knows that, you know, this place, it pretty much always bounces back. I mean, you know, right from when Boudicca burned the place down, I wouldn't bet against it. I'd be loath to, but yeah, maybe it'll be different. maybe we're in decline now.
I mean, there's so much for people who want to come see London to see.
Yeah.
And London will still have that to offer. I mean, one of my mantras is this, that, and this connects with why I'm a guide. If you go back to the beginning of the 20th century, the biggest area of urban development in the world was London. Mm. And so if you now, 120 years later, you want to say, well, where is the largest mass, urban mass, of, if you like, antique housing and industry, it's London. London's got the biggest land area, which is over 100 years old, mm-hmm, anywhere in the world. Mm-hmm. And you're never going to be able to take that away from London. Mm-hmm. And that, it was so big that it means that the number of stories there are to tell about London is pretty much infinite, that even with the number of guides that you can muster, David, in London Walks, we're only scratching the surface of this city.
Yeah, it's true.
There's only a tiny amount of what there is to show that we can do with 70 guides going out doing however many dozen walks every week. It just doesn't tell you a fraction.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you've brought up the guiding. So how did all that come about, Charlie? When did you sort of think, walking tours and I'm right for them and all of that? Were you going on them as a paying customer, as I was when I started?
I actually started guiding, really, on the Olympic Park. Uh-huh. When I was working for Hackney, I was often asked to take people around the Olympic Park, explain what was going to happen. And it was actually quite a challenging bit of guiding, because you were guiding people through a sea of mud. There was nothing to see except mud. And you had to try and create a vision of what this place was going to look like sort of 6 years, 8 years from now. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't easy, but I really enjoyed it. And I got a lot of good feedback. And of course, as the place got built, it was easier and easier, uh-huh, to give people a sense of what was coming. And then when the games were over and I felt that there was never going to be another job that would match up to that for me, it was kind of my ideal job. It was not even worth trying to find one that would match it. And that's when I thought, well, this is something I've kind of started to learn about. And that's when I went into doing a guiding course at the City of Westminster, great course, which really set me up to want to do guiding in a bigger way.
Now, have I got this wildly wrong? I thought you were doing canal walks guiding.
That's right. Having done the City of Westminster guiding course,
right,
I kind of decided to get into this, I'll do anything anyone offers or asks me to do. Uh-huh. And as I was a volunteer at the London Canal Museum, the team doing the canal walks asked me to come in and join them, which I did. And I've got an interest in canals anyway, uh-huh, and that sort of burgeons, so that I could really bore you by getting you on the canal towpath at Kensal Green and taking you all the way down to Limehouse without stopping. That would take a few hours. I think there has been a London guy that's done that.
Uh-huh.
It was a celebration of the 200th anniversary or something. Somebody actually started at 6 o'clock in the morning and kind of went all through the day because it's a long wall.
Yeah.
There's an awful lot to say on the way. But one of the reasons for getting drawn into the canal walks is it does give you this slice right through the city.
Uh-huh.
From Kensal Green is kind of as far as we tend to normally go westward, although we do occasional walks on the Grand Union Canal. And it takes you right into Docklands, quite naturally, because that's the point. That's where the canal was supposed to be going. And you've got all these different elements of the city that you're going through on the way, and you haven't got any traffic to contend with except bicyclists.
Uh-huh.
I'm a great cyclist, but I'm afraid I haven't got a lot of time for the ones on the towpath. They tend to think they have the priority, which they don't.
Yeah. I'm not sure any other London Walks guide has both the breadth and depth that you have. I'm just thinking about this. I mean, the Olympics and canals and the Westminster qualification, and then this astonishing professional background in local government and housing and my jaw's hanging open. where are you going next? What are you going to take on next, Charlie?
I'm pretty happy doing these walks, and I'm happy working with London Walks because it allows me this sort of range, you know, that you can come up with different elements that you're interested in. And because there's an audience out there wanting something new, the weekends are tour du jour. I kind of feel there's usually a bunch of people who want to hear my latest fascination. So, for example, the canals got me very interested in the role of horses in London. And then I started looking at that and started realising you can try and get people back into looking at London as it was in the horse-drawn era. And the walk that has been particularly popular when horses ran London, which is about the 1890s, horses were more and more important until the very moment that the internal combustion engine took over. And there's so much of what they needed that has still got its traces in our urban fabric.
Yeah.
And that becomes a very interesting walk to do. I'm trying to do another one, which unsuccessfully launched last week in pouring rain, everyone cancelled. But it was also about horses and how those people in power and authority have used horses as part of that power and authority. And it does a sort of loop around Buckingham Palace, somewhere that has some power and authority, to look at horses from a different perspective. So that's one of the reasons I really enjoy being part of your team.
Yeah, I mean, that whole, your stuff on horses, I've loved that. It's been so interesting, real eye-opener. I mean, revelation after revelation after revelation. Keep it up. How are you researching those? Where's some of that information coming from then?
That's been quite a wide-ranging bit of research. Some of it is about researching buildings, and then as you go back from the building, you realise why it's there and how it was used. There are a couple of wonderful books. There's a guy called Gordon who wrote a book about horses in London at the end of the 19th century. Great care, and he's almost like Mayhew in terms of trying to work out the numbers. How many thousands tons of oats do the horses of London need to keep going? You know, that kind of stuff. And actually, the other book I would recommend anyone reread, because you may well have read it when you were a child, is Black Beauty. Because it's a great manual, really, about how you should and shouldn't treat horses. And it was really written for an adult audience, not for children. And a great children's book always works for adults as well.
Yeah, and I mean, I think in the, perhaps, what, two decades into the 20th century, maybe a little longer, there was still some horse traffic. Is that right?
There was still some, but it tailed off pretty fast. I mean, the First World War was a big divider, really. A lot of horses were conscripted, really. Went to training college in Ormskirk before going to the Western Front. Very few of them came back. Even the ones even the ones that survived were auctioned off in France and Belgium. So quite a few of them ended up on Belgian butchers' slabs, I'm afraid, even having gone through everything else they'd survived. And, of course, people came back from the war having learned how to drive motor vehicles. A lot of people had learned how to drive lorries and things, and a lot of lorries were coming back, which were could be reused, repurposed for civilian use. And so you had a load of new motorized transport, a load of new people who knew how to drive, and they wanted to use that opportunity. Some, of course, were looking to be taxi drivers. Big taxi fleets had already set themselves up for the first. So yeah, there were some. So there was still some horse-drawn transport. I guess where it survived longest was where you're distributing something where you need to do lots of stops and starts. And so things like coal, milk, the rag and bone trade, wasn't it, famously still used horses? Steptoe and Sam, I think. Didn't they have a horse in that show after the Second World War?
Yeah, that's right. I take them at the start of my Kensington walk up a mews that was built in 1879, and I think the tube arrived there in 1868. So they were sufficiently confident that you know, there was going to be need for horse-drawn vehicles even after the tube had, you know, been there at least in primitive form for a few years.
Well, you're getting onto one of my stops on a walk, if you let me.
Yeah, go on.
What's really interesting is that the underground was basically the circle line was what was seen to be the way of connecting up all the main railway termini. The railways were not supposed to go any further into the centre of London. So if you arrived at that point, yeah, you could get an underground train around London, but actually until the deep level tubes at the very, very end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th, you couldn't get a train into the middle of London. So once you got, say, to Victoria Station, you want to go further in, you either had to walk, get, have a carriage waiting for you, pick you up off the platform, or get a horse-drawn bus. And so they were still really vital until the beginning of the 20th century. And so I put this to you that as a result of that, there's only one vehicle bridge I can think of within the Circle Line in London, Holborn Viaduct. I've tested this out on several people. I'm not asserting it as the fact, because I'm just waiting until someone comes up with another one. But I can't think of another vehicle bridge within the Circle Line.
That's interesting. Yeah. Yeah, I'll have to puzzle that out. Yeah, I'll bet that's right. Yeah.
Try it out.
Yeah, Charlie, these horse-drawn omnibuses, where were those horses stabled then?
Well, they had enormous stables. The big companies might need to stable 1,000 horses in the same place. And they were dotted around London. You know, obviously near the ends of some of the routes that they were working. There was one particularly big one, I think somewhere like Palmer's Green. But I'm not going to go any further because I don't definitively know the answer to exactly where those stables were. I sort of focus more on where some of the stables for the industrial and railway uses were. So Camden Lock is the last great example of a stable complex which was needed to service the railways. And that had between 800 and 1,000 horses being kept there. And much of that stabling is basically there, but you just walk, you weave your way through it as you're in Camden Lock doing your shopping, and you don't really notice how all the configuration of buildings actually worked as stable for the railway company.
Well, that, isn't that a sort of three-way thing? Because also the canal meets the railway there as well. So you've got the horse-drawn stuff on London's streets and roads, and then, you know, the towpath, the it was horsepower that was moving the barges along, and then the trains.
So, that's right. I mean, that's why I love the interchange building at the back of Camden Lock, because that word interchange is what it says what it means. It was enabling trains to be shunted in from the back end, barges to come in underneath, and then have a massive sort of marshalling yard at the side where horses and carts were waiting to take goods or bring goods in to the building.
Yeah.
And for all three functions, you needed horses, because once you got the wagons from the railway inside the building, horses had to move them around individually and bring them out and back to the marshalling yards.
Had I known you 25 years ago, I would have been able to take you right through that building, because that's where Worldwide Television News, where I worked as a journalist, where we were. So, but even then I knew a little bit about it and was, like you, was fascinated by it. So,
Yeah, so those are the sorts of things, the sort of rabbit holes I go down and come back up into the daylight and think, well, maybe someone might want to come follow me down that way.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, Charlie, your virtual tours are matchless. I mean, to start with, you're much more advanced with the kind of technology and the fancy footwork on the screen. I mean, it's just dazzling, the stuff that that. How many of those have you created? Is it two,
well,
three,
I'm
four?
I suppose I've got about half a dozen of those. They are a lot of work to put together, because I think with a virtual tour, you really have to put as much as you can into the visuals to keep people sort of connected with what you're talking about.
Uh-huh.
And because when you're out there on the street, things are much more immediate.
Uh-huh.
When you're stuck on a screen, you're trying to sort of compensate for that to some extent. So, the ones I've done so far I've done one about how John Nash developed the centre, sort of the West End of London. One about the kind of statues issues around statues. But the one I've got coming up in a couple of weeks' time, this is in July 2021, it is about what I'm calling Graveyards to Die For. And it's looking at the way we buried our dead in London from the end of the 18th century to the end of the 19th century, and had to deal with basically the massive problem of a population explosion, which is also an explosion not just in live births, but in deaths.
Sure, sure.
And how did we handle that?
Yeah.
And we did it very well in the end, I think. But,
yeah.
It has some pretty grisly interludes in the middle where bodies were not getting buried rats were enjoying themselves.
Yeah. Guide to Guide now. I'm just interested to know what your experience has been. The virtual tours for me have actually impacted my 3D shoe leather on pavement guiding. I'm now using a few visual aids. I never did. I kept them at arm's length. We had a guide for whom I had enormous respect, who said to me many years ago, I was just a youngster really, he said, oh, if you have to use pictures, you failed as a guide. And I thought, oh, well, that if he's saying that, that must be true. But I've just realized from these virtual tours, these images are so powerful. And rather than almost the way you described the Olympics, standing there in a sea of mud trying to describe something. Well, I don't take many. It's sometimes it's as few as just three or four images. Has that happened to you as well now? Or has it changed at all your shoe leather on pavement guiding?
I always used images.
But right.
The main reason is that you can use your descriptive abilities to get across to someone what a street might have looked like 100 years ago. But early photography has this enormous power that if you line people up in the right place, you can describe it, and then you whip out a photograph, and they're staring right down the street, and they can absolutely identify the fact that they're there, and that's what it used to be like 100 years ago. That It has a great impact on people. I mean, one of the places where I have the biggest impact using a photograph is taking people into Trafalgar Square. It's a walk about the First World War, and they set up an office to recruit women, which was at the edge. They had a sort of wooden shed at the edge of Trafalgar Square, and in the middle they had a recruiting sergeant sitting at a desk. And there's this great photograph of her sitting there. And you line everyone up, you stand behind where the desk is, and you whip out this picture, and you said, right, who's next? And you got the lions in exactly the same place, and this woman in front of you staring at you, basically requiring you to sign up. And the power of that picture is something you can't do in words.
Exactly.
You know? Yeah. So there are places where you can use
it. Yeah. And what about maps? Maps have been a revelation to me, largely due to the virtual tours. They're great.
Yeah, I think, again, maps can really help people to understand how a place was configured at a different time in history.
Uh-huh.
In a way that, again, words can go so far, but sometimes not. They're not adequate.
Yes, yeah. So projects, Charlie, what are you working on, new walks at all?
Well, I suppose the two that I've been working on over lockdown, I've described in some way. One is the Graveyards to Die For.
Yeah.
And the other one has been...
So you haven't debuted that one. That's about to debut, is that right?
That's about to debut on the 6th of July. See how it goes, see how much interest it is.
Yeah.
And I might well follow that. Do that again if people want to. The thing here is it's a tour that you can't do on the ground. It's about getting that overview of London.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's where the virtual tours will have more of a future, because while you turn a walk into a virtual tour when you're frustrated by not being able to do it on the street, I think there are other things that as guides we can do which give people the ability, if you like, to skim across bits of London that you can't walk in 2 hours and connect them together
uh-huh.
in ways visually, which, of course, you can't do either. So that's why I'm doing Graveyards to Die For as a virtual. And the other one is this Horses Past, Horses Present, uh-huh. which is about how horses have been used, really, as a means of asserting power and authority. And it's interesting that this walk, if people have got the stamina, it's only just over 2 miles, but it has got three kind of active stables. You've got the stables at Buckingham Palace, which have their origins right back in the 18th century with a riding school there. And, of course, there are overnight stables for the household cavalry at Horse Guards.
Mm-hmm.
And rather... I think as a sort of throwback to the way horses were kept in the 19th century, in Great Scotland Yard, the police has still got horses on a two-tier stable. And that's what they used to do to pack the horses in the late 19th century. A bit like multi-story car parks,
but yeah.
They do that there.
I love that. You know, sometimes you can see just a few bits of straw just outside the door, and
right.
sometimes and there's a certain pungency, shall we say.
I was going to say, you get the smell.
Yeah. I mean, London must have smelled like, there must have been an aroma. It must have smelled a bit like a barnyard. Anyway, into, as you say, into the second decade of the 20th century.
Yeah. Now that a lot of visitors to London did describe it, that they sort of had this particular smell, and of course you can have your crossing sweepers and people getting the manure off the streets, but I guess that quite a lot of it, you know, took a while to collect up. In a lot of ways, it was worse in dry weather because it flakes and blew in the wind and got through your windows and into your clothes and. Whereas if it was wet, you can squadge it right, with a shoe, and the bottom of your skirts would get caught in it.
Uh-huh.
But otherwise, I think you could keep yourself away from it.
Yeah, that's interesting. I can't remember. It was something I was reading yesterday. It may have been something by Jan Morris, but it was talking about the heavy, heavy London fog, and in fact, there was an advantage to it in that it kind of weighted the smells down. It prevented them from, you know, coming up off the ground very much.
Exactly what happened, because with a London smog, it's like a saucepan lid, where you've got cold air being trapped by warmer air up above it. And it creates this vicious circle. Because it's cold air, people put more coal on their fires to try and keep warm. And it's not going through the warmer air above. And so the whole thing just gets more and more fetid.
Huh. Interesting. Yeah.
It must have tasted disgusting. Just in your throat.
Yes. Maybe that's part of the reason that London was at least had the reputation of being a culinary disaster for the longest time. Because the importance of the nostrils to our sense of taste. Oh dear.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you very much, and I'm going to twist your arm, Charlie, and get you to do this again a few months down the road, because I want to pick your brain. There's a lot more to between those ears of yours about London. That's fascinating. So,
well, I was going to say you're very welcome, and I'm glad to be here because I feel part of a family with London Balls. Uh-huh. And I feel especially how much you've put into keeping this thing going, you and Mary, while we've been through a pandemic, which has not done us any favours at all, let alone everybody else. I'm not trying to make a special case for guides. We've all suffered in different ways. But I know the gardening community has been struggling.
Well, we've taken heart from you guys. I mean, it's just the way you've rallied round and, you know, are willing to go out there and take one or two or three people around. That's just, I use the analogy of the place that never closed in World War II, the windmill, we never closed. Yeah. Well, you know, I think we can pretty much say that about London Walks, and I'm proud of that. We all should be. I think we are, so.
Well, thank you, really.
Okay.
And of course, if you'd like me to come back, I'll come back.
Yeah, great stuff, Charlie. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
All best. Yeah.
Well.